Hello and welcome back to the Chris Yeh podcast. I am, as always, Chris Yeh, and I have a very, very special treat for you guys today. I am joined by one of the greatest management thinkers of our time, a man who is both incredibly learned and wise, as well as incredibly funny and fun to talk with. My friend, my bodyguard, Professor Jeff Pfeffer of Stanford University. How are you doing, Jeff?
It's a pleasure to be with you. And by the way, I miss not doing your bodyguard service the other night.
So the funny thing is, many people know of my general hatred and reluctance to go to San Francisco. And the joke is that when Jeff and I go to certain events in San Francisco together, he is my bodyguard. And the funny thing is, it's not actually a joke, because I think he would do a better job of defending against the various threats of San Francisco than I would.
Yeah, well, I would do my best.
Also, you've managed to survive for longer than I have. You've been to San Francisco many times, and you are still alive.
Yes. Well, I actually like San Francisco. San Francisco has great arts, great jazz, great opera, great symphony, and great restaurants. So I live closer to San Francisco than you do.
Fair enough. I just know that the last time I went to San Francisco, somebody smashed open the window of my car and stole my charger. So there you go. That's San Francisco to me.
Well, you cannot leave anything visible in your car, even a box of Kleenex.
Oh, it wasn't visible. They smashed into the window and pulled down the seat and then went into the trunk to get it.
Wow.
But be that as it may, this is not the time for us to complain about San Francisco. This is the time to discuss you and especially your new book, The Seven Laws of Power. But what I want to do first is I want to make sure people know a little bit about you, because I gave you, I think, a great introduction. But at the same time, not everyone has been paying attention to management thinking over the past, 20, 30, 40 years. So maybe you can help by just giving us, the quick summary of your life and what brought you to Stanford and the kind of study that you do of the nature of power.
Sure. Thank you, Chris. First of all, I'll correct you. The title of the book is Seven Rules of Power.
I knew that after I said it, but I was like, damn it, too late. I already said
it. It's fine. Anyway, so I was born. I grew up in Tucson, Arizona. Born in St. Louis, grew up in Tucson. Went to the Carnegie Mellon University for my bachelor's and master's. Worked for a year, which is a long story about, doing military manpower planning during the height of the Vietnam War. I actually had the privilege of once a month calling a guy named Fred Sufa and telling him — he worked for General Hershey, the head of the Selective Service — telling him how many people to draft. It turns out I had flat feet. That kept me out of the Army. So I went to Stanford, got my PhD, and in 1971, which is a little bit more than 50 years ago, took my first job at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. 1973, came to Berkeley. I got tenure at Berkeley. In 1979, I was hired into Stanford as a full professor at a very young age, in my early 30s. And I've been at Stanford ever since, except for 1 year visiting at Harvard Business School. Over the time I've been at Stanford, I've written 16 books, several on power, some on evidence-based management, one on the knowing-doing gap. One of my favorites was published in 2018 called Dying for a Paycheck, which talks about the workplace and human health. I've been to given talks in more than 40 countries, and that is a brief resume of who I am. And so I teach a class at Stanford called the PATHS, P-A-T-H-S, to Power, which is a very popular elective. I've taught that course on and off since I arrived at Stanford in 1979.
Now, isn't it true that I think it might be the middle volume of the Caro biography of Lyndon Johnson? Isn't it Lyndon Johnson and the Path to Power?
It is called The Path to Power. That's why I have an S on the end of mine. The Path to Power.
I gotta say, I do love those Caro biographies of Johnson, and it is an incredible study just in power. I imagine that it's probably something that you read quite deeply. And Caro also covered Moses, who you talk a lot about as well. Yes. Robert Moses, that is, not the prophet.
Yes, that is exactly right. Robert Moses, still is years after his death, they have exhibits about him in New York. He basically created a lot of New York City and state. He's called the Master Builder.
Now, the other interesting thing about you, Jeff, is we originally met through our mutual friend, Peter Eagle Sims, a remarkable and fascinating individual. And Peter always calls you Dr. No. Why does he call you Dr. No?
Well, you should probably ask Peter that. He calls me Dr. No because in the leadership literature and in the management literature in general, many people are prone to positivity and to Panglossian views of the world. And so many people write about the world as they would want it to be. And I try to write about the world as it is. If you're going to change the world, if you're going to do Stanford's motto, change lives, change organizations, and change the world, you need to begin with an understanding of what needs to be changed and why. And so that apparently is too negative for our friend Peter.
Well, Peter is certainly an idealist, a visionary, somebody who sees the world. I think this is a great George Bernard Shaw quote, which says that the reasonable man sees the world as it is, the unreasonable man sees the world as it could be. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. And I do a lot of work with the Unreasonable Group, which has that as their motto. But it is absolutely true that it is a lot easier to be unreasonable if at first you understand what reality actually is.
That's correct. And it's certainly more efficacious to change the world if you understand how that world works. I mean, if I'm going to be idealistic and say we're going to land on a man on the moon, as we once did and may do again someday if we live long enough, you need to know the laws of physics. If you're going to get from here to the moon, you better understand how thermodynamics works.
Exactly. You can't just sort of say, I really want to go to the moon, and going to the moon would be awesome. Therefore, I'm going to manifest it.
Yes, that's correct.
So let's talk about your book, which is, of course, The 7 Rules of Power.
Correct.
You've written about power multiple times before. Why did you decide to return to the well and write this book?
Well, I will be completely honest with you. Number one, this book is shorter. And people have a shorter attention span. That's number one. But number two, most importantly, as I teach my class and as I interact with executives about this topic, I am continually evolving, I would say, the best way to convey the information in the most effective manner. And so in the last book, Power, Why Some People Have and Others Don't, came out about 12 years ago. So I thought it was time, given what I had learned, to try to reconvey or to convey, first of all, new information and new research, but also the ideas more effectively. I would say there was a second reason why I wrote the book. And the second reason I wrote the book is that there is a narrative common in the world today that everything has changed. So our friend, the mutual friend, Henry Timms, has co-authored a book called New Power. Moses Guillaume, I think is his name, wrote a book called The End of Power. Mm-hmm. So there's this idea that the internet has changed everything, that social media has changed everything, and that the old rules of power don't apply, and that we're in a world, as Henry Timms would say, oftentimes in New Power, democratization, and everything is different, and Machiavelli is wrong, and all this other stuff. And it turns out that isn't true. I mean, strong men, and they are almost always men, are on the rise all over the world. Democracy mm-hmm. is in retreat. Donald Trump was elected president. I thought people needed to understand and engage again with how the world is, not how we would want it to be.
Absolutely. And I am in 100% agreement with you. Again, this notion that, hey, everything has changed, everything is different, when human nature remains the same, we still have the same genetic makeup, it always reminds me of financial manias, and we've been through one of those recently as well, when people say, this time it's different, Web3, it's all different, it's a revolution, it's ownership. And I always tell people, whenever someone tells you this time it's different, reach your hand into your pocket, cover up your wallet, and make sure that nobody gets near it.
I think that's exactly right. It's one of the reasons I'm proud to be an investor in Blitzscaling Ventures.
Oh, thank you.
Because you're such a sensible human being about these issues.
I much appreciate it. I like to believe that being evidence-based and reality-based is useful in investing as it is in the rest of the lives that we lead.
I think that's exactly correct.
Well, the way I want to go through and think about this book and talk about it is a very selfish way, which is I want to interrogate the book through the lens of my own life and
Fun.
try to figure out, the deeper understanding of power as I've exerted it and figure out if maybe there's some things I should be doing differently or if I could just pat myself on the back and say, hey, I've been living according to the lessons of Dr. Jeff Pfeffer.
I think you've certainly been living according to one of the lessons of Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer, and that is you have done, I think, an extraordinary job of following Rule 5. And Rule 5, of course, is network relentlessly. You understand. I mean, many people say networking is bad or it's whatever or it's dirty or whatever they think. But actually, the world is built upon social connections and social relationships. If management or slash leadership is getting things done through other people, the more people you know, the more you can get done. And you have done a fabulous job of building connections, authentic connections, connecting people, but also connecting ideas. So I think to me, you have definitely followed Rule 5.
Well, thank you. And it is the case with Rule 5 that I will give credit to an old management chestnut, which is to say Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. And this was a book that I actually read for the first time right as I was graduating Stanford. In many ways, I wish I had read it earlier than that, but I read it right when I was graduating, and it was like a lightning bolt into my mind because, like many people at Stanford, I had entered the school very proud of my intelligence and believing that intelligence was the overriding factor in all things that we did. And I learned quite a bit during my years at school, but it took How to Win Friends and Influence People to really crystallize it for me. And for those of you who do not recall Dale Carnegie right off the bat, How to Win Friends and Influence People is a classic written in the 1920s, sort of Depression era management thinking. It's a very much a traditional self-help book. Many people consider it one of the first self-help books, along with Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. And what How to Win Friends and Influence People tells you is that the best way to win friends and influence people is to express a sincere appreciation and interest in what others do and care about. And that is probably the principle I've followed since then, with nuances around networking.
I think that's right. Networking often is more successful if you're generous, and that's what you're talking about. Fundamentally, you just described a form of generosity. So I think that is completely right. The other thing I think that you've done, which many people do not do, is you need to spend time on this. I mean, you cannot expect to build a network as rich as yours and as filled with interesting and influential people if you basically don't spend time doing it.
Exactly. And I think it ties in, and we're going out of order, but this is fine. It ties in quite nicely with Rule 6. I think that Rule 6 is a rule of power, but it's also a rule of networking, which is you should use your power and you should use your network. People think of networking, oh, there's this resource, it's a wasting resource, and I can't tap it too often. In fact, the real answer is you got to tap it as often as you can. The more you tap your network, the more it strengthens the relationships. Ben Franklin talked about the power of reciprocity and the fact that if somebody does you a favor, the need for consistency makes them think, I like this person, that's why I'm doing them a favor. In fact, the more you exercise your network, just like the more you exercise your power, the better it becomes.
That's exactly right. And certainly, and the reason why that is that the more you use your network, and therefore the more you are able to get done and help other people get done, then people, of course, want to join your network and people want to spend more time with you because you look like you're successful. Everybody wants to be associated with success and everybody wants to be associated with getting things done. And if you don't network and don't get anything done, nobody wants to have anything to do with you.
And this is a perfect way to reach into Rule 3, which is to appear powerful. And when it comes to networking, the one piece of advice that I've given to people over and over again, and many people do not listen. Jeff, does it ever get frustrating that people don't listen to the advice you give that you know works?
doesn't get that frustrating because, I mean, my job as an educator is to try to educate people, and if they don't want to use what I teach them, it's kind of up to them. Once it gets frustrating. Frankly, it gets frustrating for me. The people who don't use this very much is the Democratic Party. So that, of course. That of course is very frustrating, but the idea that that regular people don't use this, that doesn't really frustrate me that much.
I have a lot of advice for the Democratic Party. Somehow they do not listen. They try to refuse the help when it is offered by some of the smartest people in the world, and it is a constant source of frustration.
I'm sure.
But in thinking about appearing powerful, this is something which I've told many people over time. I said, you know, what is it that I've done to build a network? One of the most important things I did is that I took advantage of certain branded relationships. In my case, it would be with Stanford or with Harvard Business School or what have you, to become an organizer of events. I also was part of something called Silicon Valley Forum for a long time. And the amazing thing about organizing an event is, first of all, every volunteer organization is starved for resources and starved for people to do things. So if you offer to do anything, they'll immediately say yes and offer their support. The second thing is, if you create an event and you invite the people to the event, what will they see when they go to the event? They will see that their friend Chris Yeh knows everybody at this event, and therefore he must know everybody in the world. He must be enormously powerful and influential, when in fact, I've stacked the deck.
That's exactly right. And the other thing I thought you were going to talk about is appearing powerful is, of course, your famous book, Blitzscaling, with Reid Hoffman, which was, of course, an amazingly important, that goes to rule four, build a powerful brand. You've done this by, and as you've just done it in the words that you just said. You've built an association with Stanford. You've built an association with Reid Hoffman. Everybody says Stanford's great. Reid Hoffman's great. He's the, founder of LinkedIn, blah, blah. Therefore, if Chris Yeh knows these people, if Chris Yeh is associated with Stanford, Chris Yeh must be hot, big hot guy.
This was also one of my other secrets when I was coming up and didn't have, wasn't nearly as famous and hadn't yet started writing books with Reed or anything like that. I was able to accomplish this through a specific hack, which is organizations would call on me to moderate panels. Now, most people are not very good panel moderators, and they're always struggling to find moderators for panels. But if you moderate a panel, the key thing is you are on stage with the panelists. And
Correct.
so I would moderate all these panels full of influential people whom I would get to meet. And bear in mind, the fact that you sit on stage with them doesn't mean you develop a relationship with them per se, although you have more of an opportunity than most people. But what it does do is everyone in the audience now perceives you as being much more powerful than perhaps you really are.
That is exactly correct. As a matter of fact, it was, I think, just yesterday. I'm launching a podcast myself called Pfeffer on Power, which will launch in September. And it's what's interesting is yesterday I was talking to Laura Chow, a former Stanford student who is a partner in Kanan Partners, a venture capital firm, and she's in the consumer tech space. And one of the ways in which she has built her brand is exactly that. Moderate panels, put on events, be associated with the high status people who come to her events. I mean, Chris, you didn't need to read my book. You know it all.
Well, but then we also have to get into some of the areas where I don't think that there's any way in which I disagree with your book. I agree with all the rules of power that you lay out. However, I think that there are some interesting nuances that we can explore, because I think that one of the things that you describe in the book is how many people are uncomfortable with the exercise of power. And there are forms of power that I'm uncomfortable exercising. I famously have told various people in companies, I'm like, listen, there's many people who respond to different forms of leadership. But I told them, if you need a yeller, I'm not going to be it. This is not the way it's going to work. And so there's certain ways of expressing power which can be effective, right? Expressing anger,
Yes.
yelling at people, abusing people that I'm just unwilling to do. And we'll get into the reasons for why I'm unwilling to do it. But I think that I want to provide this as an example of how you can exercise power responsibly and effectively without necessarily being the stereotypical power mad dictator.
That is correct. But I also would point out to you that one of the things that you've done is you are basically, and if I say this incorrectly, you of course should correct me, but
Sure.
you are basically an independent entrepreneur. So you, while you are a partner in Blitzscaling, which has just started recently, but fundamentally you are a solo actor. You're an entrepreneur for yourself. You have a brand of yourself, and therefore you don't have People trying to take you down or take you out. You don't have to climb, as one of my friends calls it, the greasy pole. You don't have to work up an organizational hierarchy. You know, if you don't like your boss, you can look in the mirror and say, behave differently. So you, in some sense, have a relatively low level of daily interdependence, or you have a more diversified set of dependencies than most people who have a boss that they damn well better get along with, and have peers that are both competitors and people who help them do their jobs. So they have this mixed motive relationship and they have a bunch of subordinates. You have a much simpler life than that.
Now that is an absolutely amazing insight and a really important one. I have deliberately structured my life this way. So I had the experience earlier in my career of climbing up ladders, of running large organizations, and I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. I decided that it was a lot of work and that, and we talked about this before we started recording, my own opinion on being a CEO is that if you are a caring, responsible individual, as I am, for better or worse, then being CEO is the worst job in the world. And I was last a CEO in the year 2007. It was an incredibly draining experience. There were a whole bunch of reasons for that, but no matter what, it's draining. And my children were young, and I said, I'm not going to do this again until they got older. And by the time my children got old enough where I would contemplate potentially going back again, I said, you know what? I like my life the way it is. I've got everything I need. Why am I ever going to do that? And so I feel that you have really hit upon an insight. It's a deliberate choice I've made. Now, mind you, it is not completely true that I'm a purely solo actor. What it means is that I'm really a facilitator and Correct. That I work with other people who are themselves entrepreneurial, who want to accomplish things, who Yes. bring their own skills to bear. My co-author, Reid Hoffman, of course, I think is a very brilliant guy, but he happens to not have enough time to write books on his own. And it's also the case that he might be, you know, so intelligent that it's difficult for him to express himself in a way which normal people can understand. And I can be a good translator for that. Or for Blitzscaling Ventures, I have a couple of partners who come in and have the skills to invest in companies and build these relationships, but may not be as good at expressing and telling the story and convincing the CEOs to let the company in to invest. And so these are the kinds of roles I play, the things that I believe I'm good at and enjoy. And I've deliberately crafted my entire life around having a daily set of activities that I enjoy and I'm good at.
And you have to understand, and of course your listeners already understand this, that you, to have a job, as you just described it, a job which number one, plays to your strengths, which is important, and number two, that you love, puts you in a tiny, tiny, tiny minority because most people have jobs that they hate.
That is correct. And I am also one of these people who has considered himself lucky from the time I was very young. And I do think that there's a lot of research that shows that people who believe that they're lucky are actually luckier, do get better results. Part of that is you only start to believe that you're lucky if things are generally good for you. You don't become an optimist. There are very few Panglossians who are saying that I live in the best of all possible worlds while losing their nose from syphilis. Yes. And so as a result, of course, there is some endowment effect, if you will, of people having good things already that cause them to feel lucky. But that feeling of luckiness, that feeling of believing that you're happy and that you have all these things. I mean, again, it's the Matthew effect. To Yep. him that has, more shall be given.
Yep. And the other thing that I think your story illustrates is it also illustrates, I think, rule one, which is get out of your own way. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that I think that has made you effective is that you do not come in. I mean, I don't know you that well, but I certainly don't see you 24/7. But my sense of you is you do not come into situations with a bunch of ideas that you don't deserve it, or, you know, this imposter syndrome thing, which we discussed in the Silicon Guild. You don't come into situations with a bunch of self-handicapping ideas. You know, pardon me, I'm an Asian American, and as we know from the Ascend Foundation research, there's a lot of discrimination against Asian Americans, and some people who are discriminated against, say, you come in with a chip on their shoulder, you know, and all these other things. My sense is that you come in with a sense of entitlement is the wrong word, but it's a sense
confidence.
Of that confidence, which is very important because confidence is often assumed to signal competence, but also a sense of that you deserve what you get. You deserve what you have, and you don't feel guilty about it or apologetic or any of these other things.
Absolutely. That is 100% true. And it really boils down to, again, accepting reality. The way I believe it makes it possible for me, and people often use the expression, you know, people who feel at home in their own skin. I always find that a strange expression, but nonetheless, that's what people say. And I am very comfortable in that sense, although I wish that maybe I'd lost a little bit more weight before going on camera, but you know, whatever. The key is that I embrace reality. I do not attempt to project an image of myself that is untrue. I am never worried that people are going to find out, oh my God, they're going to discover me. I'm just like, well, if it's not true, I'm just going to say it. And by the way, many cases in this world, if you tell people, hey, that's not true, or you say, you know, I'm actually not that expert at this or that, they'll think you're humble and just give you more credit anyways.
Yes. But they will only think you're humble and give you credit if you've already accomplished stuff.
True.
So peremptorily being too humble, I think, is a problem. A quote from the last book on power I wrote comes from the late Golda Meir, who's famously said, don't be so humble, you're not that good. So humbleness humbleness is charming in a person with your level of accomplishments. Humbleness without that level of accomplishments often winds up, handicapping the person.
Absolutely. And humility is not self-deprecation. Humility is simply recognizing reality.
Sure.
And far too many confuse the two.
Yep.
So one of the key distinctions when it comes to power that I'm very curious about and I was looking forward to talking about today is the distinction between power and perhaps its cousin or subset, influence. How do you think of the interaction of power and influence? Is influence power? Is power influence? How should I think about this?
Yeah, well, I would say, I mean, there's a classic academic definition of this. Power is potential. So you have power because of your relationships, or you may have power because of your network, or you may have power because of your control over resources, or you may have power because of your mental acuity or speaking ability, whatever. Influence is power in use.
Mm.
So power is potential. It's the difference, I guess, between voltage and amps in electricity. Voltage is, you know, the potential. And then, you know, once you turn the current on, you get amps at various levels. So power is potential. Influence is power in use.
Now that's very interesting because I often think of myself as focusing on influence, which is,
yes,
in my mind, the exercise of power, but often by indirect means or voluntary means. And the reason I believe it makes sense is that the power to command is largely an illusion. I tell people all the time, leadership is an illusion. And the first law of leadership, and I call this Hannibal's first law because Hannibal Barca, the great Carthaginian general, said this, is do not give orders that will not be followed. Leadership is a fragile illusion. And if you're going to be viewed as leading the parade, you have to make sure that you don't turn in a direction where people aren't going to follow you.
That is exactly right. And I don't know if you are old enough to remember this, but there's a classic movie with Sally Field called Norma Rae, in which he stops all the machines in the factory. I mean, basically, when people stop working, the machines stop. And nobody can turn them back on unless the workers are willing to turn them back on.
And that is the thing. People often do not realize the power that they have.
Yep, I think that's right.
Now, and another high-level thing about power that I'm curious about is the relationship between power and responsibility. Because in many ways, responsibility inhibits the exercise of power, and yet power often comes with responsibility, and responsibility can sometimes increase your power. So how do those things interact?
Well, I think there are powerful people who are irresponsible, and there are powerful people who are responsible. So I see them as being quite independent.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why we're dying for a paycheck, which talks about the workplace and human health. My friend Bob Chapman, who wrote a book called Everybody Matters, runs this conglomerate called Barry Waymiller. And he said to me, which I think is true, that when people come to work, they have entrusted their psychological and physical well-being to the people who run that company and create its culture. And just as in the case of the physical environment, there are leaders who are good stewards of the lives and the human assets and the human resources that have been trusted to them. And there are people who are bad stewards. And, you know, and so this isn't really an issue of stewardship. Responsibility, to me, is not synonymous with, but it certainly connotes this idea of being a good steward mm-hmm. of the power and the resources and the human lives that have been entrusted to you. And as we know from looking at the physical environment, or for that matter, the human environment, some leaders are good stewards, some leaders aren't.
Yeah. And part of, I think, the mechanism of action here is if you are perceived to be a good steward, then oftentimes the wise will give you the power because they believe that you will be the one who is most likely to exercise it in the right way. And whether that is in the form of our friend Peter Sims arm twisting me into helping run the Silicon Guild, or, you know, my work with my wonderful co-author Reid Hoffman, I think that part of what allows people to trust me is the fact that they believe I will be a good steward of that trust and that I have demonstrated good stewardship in the past.
Yes, I think that's right. But as we know from looking at the political world around the world,
it's not the only way.
It is definitely not the only way. I mean, I just came back from Spain. I was in Spain in June, and one of the people in the course I was teaching is from the Philippines. And as we know, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. from the Marcos family.
Back.
Yes. And by the way, was elected.
I know.
And I highly recommend to your listeners, if they haven't seen it, go see the documentary, The Kingmaker, which is the story of Imelda Marcos. And prior to the re-election of Ferdinand, or the election of Ferdinand Marcos Jr., there's this documentary of Imelda. That is the same Imelda accused of looting the Philippines, closets full of shoes, blah, blah, blah. She's back in the Philippines, paving the way for the election of her son. And you know, and it's like, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. I mean, this is a family that was literally driven out of the country, and he is now elected. And the guy in my class said, well, you know, there are people who still, you know, remember his father. And I called him on it. This is a guy, dean of a business school in the Philippines. And I said, didn't he win an overwhelming majority of the vote from all the young people? And the Philippines, of course, is a young country because of their birth rate. And he said, yes, actually they did. He won a lot. He won a large majority of even the young vote. So here's the guy, you know, I mean, it is amazing. That really illustrates, I think, Rule 7, which is that once you have power and influence, everything will be forgiven or forgotten. The Marcoses are back in the Philippines.
Absolutely. And let's talk about Rule 7, which is success excuses almost everything. I think that that's one way of putting it. The other way I put it is that, as you said, using your power, power begets power. I find, and maybe you found this as well, although you've been famous for much longer than I have.
I've been alive for much longer than you have. That's the problem.
My commentary here is that the more famous I become, the easier it seems it is for me to persuade people. The trappings of fame and influence make it easier to do all the things that you did before, whether that is to convince people, to give a speech, in many ways, like, for example, networking. If I want to reach out to someone, I can just do it and they'll probably connect to me regardless of whether there's a good reason to, simply because of the power base and reputation I've already built up.
That's correct. And that really illustrates, I mean, it ties Rule 7 to Rule 4, the rules are not independent, which is, you know, it is easier for you now to make those connections because your brand is stronger, because of the books you've written, and because of the events you've organized, and because of your panel moderation, and all of these things.
I want to add another thing that I think is an underappreciated hack that, again, most people don't listen to me about. So one of the things I like to say when it comes to the events is to let the event do the work. And what I mean is this: if I'm going to speak at a conference, in many ways, I prefer the smaller conferences. I prefer the smaller but more elite conferences, like speaking to a YPO audience or something like that. People might say, well, but Chris, you speak to audiences with thousands of people. I'm like, yeah, but most of those people don't matter. I'd rather speak in a room with 20 people, all of whom matter, and who now feel a much stronger connection to me as a result of that. What do you think of that?
I think that's right. And I think part of the problem, and I'll be interested in your reaction to this. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem with social media is you go on LinkedIn or you tweet or something, and the question, and oftentimes people get caught up, how many people responded, how many people commented, how many whatever. If those, you know, if two people respond and one is Barack Obama and the other is Joe Biden, it doesn't matter if you only got two responses. You know, so I think people have confused quantity with quality, and your comment, I think, really nicely highlights that.
Yes. Now, there is absolutely a role for quantity, which is to say cast a broad net because you don't know what's going to be turn up, but you have to have the ability to discriminate and figure out when you haul in that catch, what is bycatch and what is actually something valuable. One of the most fascinating things as I was raising Blitzscaling Ventures is I was on vacation visiting my in-laws in Central Florida. And I happened to receive a LinkedIn outreach, cold LinkedIn outreach from someone saying, hey, I'd like to learn more about how you work with people who are interested in blitzscaling. And it was cold outreach from someone, and I looked him up and I was like, huh, that's interesting. There's some interesting things that he has done in his life. And I did a little more Googling, and I quickly learned that this was in fact a member of a prominent family that had been in a, that had a lot of success over the years. And I ended up communicating with him and helping him with a company. And then he later became one of our largest investors, or basically he and Reed invested the same amount of money in Blitzscaling Ventures, which is a fairly large amount for me, not for them, but for me. And this was something where I had never done any outreach to this person, but because of the book, the branding, and everything else, he had filtered his way through and reached out to me. And so this is an example of, yes, cast a broad net, but then also know who you're actually talking with.
Yeah. And you also, I think your story also illustrates something which I have trouble sometimes convincing people of, which is that the connections that matter and the ties that are often the most useful are the weak ties.
Yes.
You know, because weak ties provide people non-redundant information and contacts. And the people that you're very strongly tied to, like very close friends and family, tend to know both the same people and the same things you do.
Yes, and it is absolutely the case that weak ties were very important for something like fundraising as well.
Yes.
You know, you're someone I know well, and that's an example of a stronger tie. But I literally went out to every one of my Stanford classmates or Harvard Business School classmates who I thought had a decent chance of remembering who I was and who had a decent chance of having money. And it was sometimes surprising some of the people who said, oh, I want to be in, even though maybe we hadn't spent that much time interacting, but obviously something had made an impression on them and made them decide they wanted to do this. And other people who I just barely got to know then would refer other people who would invest millions of dollars. I mean, this was a remarkable example of the power of weak ties.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think people misestimate the power of knowing somebody versus not, versus knowing them well versus knowing them a little bit. The
yes.
difference between knowing them a little bit and knowing them well is much smaller than the difference between not knowing them and knowing them at all.
And a lot of this reluctance, I think, springs from the same thing that causes many people to be unwilling to engage in sales, which, as we know, is one of the most lucrative of professions. And that is the fear of rejection.
Yes.
People just don't want to be rejected, even though the rejection doesn't matter, even though the rejection does not damage the relationship if you couch the request in the right way, people are still reluctant to be rejected. And having experienced so much rejection in my life, I don't fear it as much. I actually had this happen with my daughter. She was applying to colleges. She was concerned because she wasn't getting into all of them. And my wife was concerned. And I told them, listen, that's because you guys are used to always being accepted into everything that you do. I'm used to rejection all the time. So this doesn't bother me. It's going to work itself out.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think there are two sayings, you know, I mean, in sales, or in many, or, you know, even in science, the CEO, the ex-CEO for many years ago of Genentech said that if, you know, he had good news and bad news for that year, the good news is that all of the projects worked. And the bad news is that if all of the projects work, they were not pushing the frontiers of the science.
That's
you know,
right.
And so if every request you make is accepted, you haven't really pushed beyond your comfort zone. You haven't really pushed the boundaries. And then there's another saying, which I think is right. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
That's right. All right. So I want to cover some of these other rules because I know that it is late on a Friday night and you generously are willing to give me more time. But I want to make sure we cover all of it so we have plenty of time to do whatever the heck else we want. So we talked about rule number one, get out of your own way, imposter syndrome, which again is something that I have never really felt in my life. I feel very fortunate of that. But for whatever reason, I haven't felt it. And I think it's because I don't claim to be something I'm not. But rule number two is an interesting one, which is break the rules. You appear more powerful if you break the rules. And if, obviously, as we've talked about, somebody like Donald Trump exemplifies this. If you break the rules and get away with it, you appear more powerful. If you break the rules and get punished and slapped down, you're not more powerful. But if you break the rules and get away with it, you're more powerful.
That is correct. And I think, you know, I think breaking the rules, you can place this in a variety of different contexts. But if you think about social change, you know, Nelson Mandela became the father of South Africa while he was in prison. He not only broke the rules, he broke the law. Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail was written while he was in a Birmingham jail. Rosa Parks broke the rule that black women were supposed to sit in the back of the bus by sitting in the front of the bus. The people who were beaten and arrested for sitting at the lunch counters at Woolworths during the civil rights movement obviously broke the rules. So rules tend to favor the people in power. So if you are in a powerful position, by all means, adhere to the rules, enforce the rules. But if you are not in a position of power, if you are an underdog, then breaking the rules gives you basically your best and maybe only chance of success. And certainly, to quote the late Congressman
John Lewis,
exactly. You know, you got to get into trouble. You got to make good trouble. Social change comes, basically, not only social change. Think about organizational innovation. Think about Steve Jobs and all the rules he broke in electronics. Think about Herb Kelleher, who decided because they didn't have enough planes that they were going to fly point to point rather than hub and spoke. Think about Whole Foods and John Mackey, who decided not to try to minimize costs, but to understand that people would pay more for food they wanted to eat, and therefore the selections in the Whole Foods in Boston, Austin, and San Francisco would be different. So if you think about strategic innovation, let alone personal power, a lot of the innovation comes from companies that have been willing to be different.
And this comes down to this notion of being contrarian and right. If you think about it, being a contrarian just means you're willing to break the rules of conventional wisdom. But of course, you have to be right. You can't just sort of say, I'm just going to break rules and I'm wrong in how I break the rules. So I just got to break them anyways. That doesn't help you. No. You've got to actually be able to be right.
Yes. But part of being right means that you have the power to make yourself be right. So, it is interesting. And, you know, I actually was on a Zoom call with the people, or Zoom event, with the people from the Washington Post who had written the book about how many lies Donald Trump had told at that time, since this, of course, is a constantly increasing number. And, and I asked them, I said, is his lying a bug or is it a feature? Is he powerful in spite of the fact he lies, or is he in fact powerful because he lies? Which is an interesting thing to think.
I think the answer is quite clear. He's powerful because he lies. I actually wrote a blog post about this some time ago when I said Donald Trump has hacked the system. He's discovered that there's a group of people who will be for whoever the mainstream media is against. And it's very easy to get bad publicity. It's hard to get good publicity, but it's very easy to get bad publicity. And by generating constant bad publicity, he was able to build up a tremendous following.
That's exactly right. And all that publicity, I mean, there was an estimate done after the 2016 election of how much free publicity he got. I would watch the anti-Trump channels. I actually watched a Hillary Clinton ad during the 2016 campaign, in which the ad, you know, if you had seen that ad without sound, you would have thought it was an ad for Trump.
Exactly. And Donald Trump has always illustrated one of the principles that I adopted when I was in marketing. And this is a saying that I came up with myself, and it's a Chris Yeh original. I always said, you know what? There's no such thing as bad publicity unless it involves a perp walk.
That's correct. I
And
think that is.
we will see what happens if, in fact, there is a perp walk with
There
former
may be.
President Trump.
There may be, but he has certainly pushed the boundaries.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about breaking the rules again, just for a second. So one of the things is you mentioned, you know, those who are in power are reluctant to break the rules. Those who are on the inside are reluctant to break the rules. And in many ways, you could argue that I'm on the inside. Like, I don't know, like all Americans like to feel like they're an underdog. But let's face it, you know, I went to Stanford as an undergraduate. I went to Harvard Business School. I worked for D.E. Shaw, world famous hedge fund. I worked with Reid Hoffman, world famous founder of LinkedIn and things like that. And so in many ways, I'm on the inside, which means that I don't necessarily want to break all the rules. There are rules that I typically want to follow because they serve my purposes. But then there are other rules that I don't follow. And this is the way I think about it. I think about breaking rules without being disagreeable.
Yes.
Now, disagreeableness is very powerful sometimes, and great entrepreneurs are often disagreeable. This is one of the reasons I got out of entrepreneurship, because I am fundamentally a very agreeable person, not disagreeable at all.
Yeah, I think that's right. So you have found, as we've already discussed, the perfect niche for you. Yeah, it wouldn't be the perfect niche. You know, I don't think you could do what Elon Musk does.
Oh, good God, no.
And I don't think Elon Musk could do what you do.
Definitely not. And to me, I'm like, in terms of rule breaking, I'm willing to break norms that I do not consider important. So whether it is in terms of being more willing to do things that other people are not. So, for example, unlike many of our peers, I have gone on a television game show to compete. And I have done various sort of performances on stage and things like that. I've done karaoke singing at the end of a speaking engagement. And so I do all these various things that I think will reflect what I want to do, but are viewed as being eccentric or colorful rather than being disagreeable.
Yes. And I think it's important. I mean, you said it earlier, that publicity is what matters. You know, I will not hire you if I don't know who the hell you are and remember you. I mean, that is the first rule of, you know, I mean, nobody gets hired by people who don't remember them. And so memorability, I think, is underestimated as how important it is.
Absolutely. One of the things that happens to me all the time, and this is something that, you know, again, we're talking just between you and I and all the listeners, of course, but it happens from time to time that people will come up to me and they'll say, oh my gosh, Chris, it's so good to see you. And there'll be a classmate of mine from Stanford or Harvard Business School whom I do not remember at all, but they remember me because I did a lot of things to be memorable to them.
And I think that's very important. By the way, when I wrote a case on Jason Calacanis, the famous This Week in Startups guy, the famous This Week in Startups guy, you know, I think one of the things that he's told, and he's been on CNBC Squawk Box a lot and whatever, is that he takes controversial positions. Mm-hmm. When Travis Kalanick was considered to be, you know, persona non grata because his comments about, you know, Boober rather than Uber or whatever, Jason defended Travis. And so, I mean, part of the lesson of Jason Calacanis is to be, you know, I mean, not to change your opinion every nanosecond, but also not necessarily to say what everybody expects you to say.
Absolutely. And Jason is another great exemplar of following these rules of power. I mean, Jason is another person you could probably write an entire book about his exercise of power and what he's been able to do over the years.
Yeah, no, that is right. And he, you know, but I will also tell you, when he comes to my class, he is not the most popular visitor, as you might imagine, because he's, you know, he's a little...
He's controversial.
He's controversial. He's a little egotistical. It's all fine. But, you know, in my class, oh my God, this is such an important insight. So my class will often say about my visitors, you know, they like this one or they don't like that one. And I keep telling them the line from my dear friend, Gary Loveman, who was a Harvard Business School professor who went on to run Caesars and then was a senior executive at Aetna and now has a startup called Well. Gary Loveman came to my class and made this comment, which rings in my ear to this day. You want to be like a dog. Your job in the world is basically to make things happen, not to win some popularity contest unless you're running for political office. I mean, except for vote counting, and maybe in 2024, votes counting won't even matter. But in any event, except for that, your job is to be effective. You know, I mean, Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, many of these people are not particularly likable or nice or whatever. But the issue is, are you able, you know, to create stuff? Are you able to make stuff happen?
And this really ties into rule three, which we haven't talked about as much, but appear powerful. One of the things you talk about in rule three is you can appear powerful by doing things like being angry. And again, these are some of the tools that I just cannot use. I'm not very good at being angry. I'm very rarely angry. It happens every once in a while. I'm told it is absolutely terrifying on the one or two occasions it's happened, but it really doesn't happen very often. I don't have that as a tool at my disposal. What I will do is I will express disappointment, right? I will take a softer approach to it. But I think that the reason I can be warm and affable and all these things, the reason I have the luxury to do that is the combination of brand building. But part of that brand building, a part of what has allowed me to do this, is what I would describe as competence through obvious virtuosity. So there are things that I do, like speaking and on stage and answering questions and things like that, where it's obvious virtuosity. That means that people are like, okay, this person knows their thing. This person is powerful. Therefore, if they are generous or kind or affable, that's okay too, because we have already established that they're competent. Now we're establishing that they're also a positive person. Hey, that's even better.
Yep, that's exactly right. And as you have just said, and as research by Susan Fiske, a social psychologist from Princeton, has demonstrated, warmth and competence are the two fundamental dimensions by which we evaluate both people and groups. And while, of course, they are conceptually independent, they are often seen to be negatively related. That warm people are seen as incompetent. Amy Cuddy, the famous presence woman, has an HBR article entitled "Just Because I'm Nice, Don't Assume I'm Dumb." You know, because that's it. So you, in fact, have done what Robert Cialdini, the author of Influence, would suggest: demonstrate competence first, and then people will say, considering how smart he is, he's such a nice guy.
Exactly. That is the key for people who want to go through and appear powerful without necessarily exercising power in that sort of hard-edged conflict way, which is demonstrate your competence first. Then you can be warm. Then you can be kind.
Yep.
Now let's talk about building a brand, because you said that I've been good at building a brand. I think that I have been good at building brand as well. That's my area of expertise, marketing and thinking about brands. But it's something that I think is deep-seated. And I always remember this. My very first job after I graduated from Stanford, I worked for D.E. Shaw, which of course is famously the company Jeff Bezos worked for before he started Amazon. He quit to start Amazon. He quit 18 months before I arrived. So I don't know Jeff, unfortunately. Otherwise, perhaps my life would be different. But back when I was at D.E. Shaw and I just came in, it was clear to me that I had a different approach than many of my other colleagues who had come in the same class of recent college graduates. And I was always very conscious of the brand and the impression I was making. And one of the people at the company who became a mentor of mine, who was a Harvard Business School graduate and who later wrote a recommendation for me to go to business school and remains a friend to this day, he said, "You know, Chris, you are a shameless self-promoter, and I mean that in the most positive possible sense."
I love it. I love it. You know, so if we were talking about strategy, and in some sense we are, we're just talking about personal strategy rather than business strategy. But if this were a podcast about business strategy, we would be talking about the importance of differentiation. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what you have just described, how you stand out from a group of other people.
Exactly. And it's the simplest, silly sort of things. It's like, okay, well, here I am. I'm working at D.E. Shaw and Company. And because of that, it means I can wear whatever I want. But you know what? I'm going to wear dress shirts and slacks as opposed to a t-shirt and jeans like all my other colleagues. I'm going to differentiate myself and appear different. I'm going to do things differently than everyone else because I want to be different.
Yes. And the trouble It's not trouble. It's probably the wrong choice of words. But the issue is that we all want to both fit in and stand out.
Yes.
And of course, fitting in and standing out, if you think about it, simultaneously are contradictory impulses. I want to be exceptional, but I also want to fit in. And in strategy, I sometimes would say to people, you know, in order to be an extraordinarily successful organization, you cannot benchmark. You cannot benchmark your way to the top. You benchmark your way to the middle. So in order to be exceptional, you have to actually be exceptional in the sense of being an exception to the rules, being an exception. But the countervening motives to both fit in and stand out oftentimes get in people's way.
Now, again, I've never thought about these issues before, which is why this is so fascinating. Right? We're doing all this live, which is awesome. One of the things that comes to mind about fitting in and standing out, and at least the way I think about it in my own mind as I look over my own life, is it's a question of fitting in a one-on-one situation and standing out in groups.
Yep, I think that's right. But it's also, sometimes it's also fitting into the groups. As you know, group conformity pressure is very, very powerful.
Right. And it's a question of how do you both fit in and stand out? Can you signal to the group that you share many of their same values?
Yes.
Because that's what groups care about, while at the same time standing out. I mean, and again, this is so fascinating to think about it because I've never really thought about this before. But even going back to when I was an undergraduate at Stanford, I went to Stanford young. I had skipped a couple of grades because I went to a gifted school for children, which meant that I was 15 when I started at Stanford. Although, as I always point out, I turned 16 not long afterwards. I happened to have a birthday late in the year. But that means that no matter what, you are always going to stand out. If you are a 15-year-old freshman, you are going to stand out. And, you know, there were things about my life that was a result of my age that were different than my friends at Stanford. So, for example, you know, I would not drink alcohol, partially because I was way too young for it, and partially because I didn't see a particular need for it. But these are ways that you can stand out while at the same time fitting in the same sense of not being a scold and saying, you guys shouldn't drink alcohol, et cetera. I'm like, hey, listen, you guys are more fun when you're drinking alcohol. Go ahead and drink all you want. I'm just not going to do it. I don't need it myself.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And, you know, it's interesting when you talk about underage drinking. As you know, that remains a scourge in colleges. Mm-hmm. And drinking, which I think many people don't quite understand, alcohol is a depressant.
That's right.
And so therefore, it may give you a temporary high, but it really then brings you down. And so it's really not a good thing to overdrink because it's holding aside every other thing. It basically puts you in a bad mood.
An interesting note is that I've only been drunk once in my life. The only reason I was drunk is that my wife said, I am very curious what you'll be like if you're drunk. And so we sat down in a controlled environment in what was then my apartment in Cambridge, Massachusetts that we shared. And I drank a extremely large amount of alcohol, not enough to make me sick. Fortunately, I have a good tolerance for these things. And she said that it was very disappointing because the main thing that happened was that I was unable to control the volume of my voice. So I became very loud. And I became physically clumsy because, you know, the alcohol was interfering with my coordination. Yeah. But it did not.
Which is why people mostly tell you not to drive drunk.
Yes, that's a very good reason why you don't drive drunk. But it did not have any impact. It did not actually change the way my basic personality worked. It just made me louder and clumsier.
Yeah. So I would, you know, that's.
So what's the point of drinking alcohol? That's what I say.
Well, you know, so if you ask, so many people, there are, of course, people who are alcoholics who ought to get treatment who drink by themselves. But most people drink in social situations.
That's right.
Because if you don't drink and everybody else is drinking, while you may be comfortable, you know, there's a lot of social pressure to do what everybody else is around you doing.
That's right, which is why drinking sparkling water with a twist of lime is always a good option.
Yep, it looks like a gin and tonic.
Now, let's continue on this process of branding. There's another element of branding that I think that many people are reluctant to do, but which I embrace, which is what I call play the hits. And what I mean is this: everyone feels themselves, I don't want to be reduced down to one or two words. I don't want to be a stereotype of myself. I don't want to play this caricature. And my response to that is, guess what? That's all people are going to remember. Our mutual friend, Bob Sutton, a wonderful, wonderful man, always struggles with the fact that he's going to go to his grave and on
He's
his
the asshole
gravestone,
man.
he's going to be the asshole man. And I said, Bob, that's fantastic. You own the word asshole in people's minds. This is wonderful.
Yes.
And you can tell that one of the things I'd done once I discovered that blitzscaling had resonated with people was to brand it in every aspect possible and to play the hits, as opposed to being one of those bands who said, I'm going to play something off the new album. I'm like, no. We're going
No,
to play the hits.
no.
We're going to make people like the concert.
I think all powerful brands, including brands of people, but in brands of products as well, are simple and repeated. You know,
Yes.
Jack Welch said this about organizational culture, that building an organizational culture required leaders to be relentless and boring. Building a brand requires you to be relentless and boring.
Exactly. And again, but the funny thing, I'll add a nuance. You have to be relentless and boring to yourself. That
Yes.
is the problem. People get bored of playing the hits because it's their own perception. What they don't realize is that audience out there did
Is
not see,
new. That
they're
audience
new.
is new. You know,
Exactly.
when people meet you for the first time, they don't know that you're tired of blitzscaling. They think this is a new idea.
Exactly. The good news is I'm not tired of it. I revel in playing the hits. If I were Led Zeppelin, I'd be like, Stairway? Awesome. Let's play Stairway to Heaven. I love the way the crowd reacts. Now, let's continue. We're still covering the various rules. Rule number five, network relentlessly. One of the secrets to networking that I've told people is that you need to do two things, and most people forget the second one. And I think this ties in with what you said. You got to put in the work. You have to meet smart and interesting people, but then you have to stay in touch and have the patience for those people, like fruit on the vine, to ripen and mature and become the world's leaders.
And I've seen people do this with Christmas newsletters or with updates or with, in today's world with all this electronics and, communication media, you can do it more easily. But yes, you need to stay moderately front of mind.
Exactly. And the key is, again, staying in touch in a way like the Christmas newsletters, I always love receiving them. Don't get me wrong. I love receiving people's Christmas newsletters. I don't know if they provide that same level of branding. I've always been a bigger proponent of engaging with people, those people that you want to stay in touch with, on things that they think would be interesting. Right?
Yes.
Providing them access to things that they think would be interesting, reaching out to them about things that you have in common, that's the way to do it.
No, that's exactly right. And you want to bring information that can be useful to those people to their attention, in case they may have missed it.
Yes. Rule number six, use your power. The nuance around using your power that I want to explore is twofold. The first is I think that one of the ways to demonstrate power is by helping others. And this is actually one of the most powerful ways of exercising power because it produces the effect of people realizing that you're powerful, but also that you're benevolent, which increases their desire to spend time with you.
Yep, that is certainly right. You can use your power to help people, but I would also argue, as I do in that chapter, that you want to use your power differentially. So I don't want to help everybody.
Oh, yes.
I want to help the people who are aligned with me and who are helping me and who share my goals and values and can be helpful to me. But people who oppose me and get in my way, I don't think you necessarily want to be helpful to.
Oh, no. And in fact, it is frequently the case that I will go ahead and call their bluffs because it is remarkable in this world how often the people who are opposed to you or thinking something differently will attempt to bluff you and will attempt to convince you to not exercise your power merely by offering some sort of a threat. And my response to that is generally to ask, okay, where does the power in this relationship actually lie? Far too many people bluff when they, in fact, are on the losing end of the power equation, in which case I say, oh, okay, if you want to bluff, I'm going to call it.
Yep, I think that's exactly right.
Now, the other thing that's interesting when it comes to using power is the notion of entrepreneurship. And this is another saying that I've used many times in the way I think about power, which is that I tell people I have a nearly unlimited tolerance for uncertainty, but I have a nearly zero tolerance for downside. And I'm curious what you think of that.
Explain again. I mean, I heard Richard, the words that you said. What do you mean an almost zero tolerance for downside?
So let me describe how often people think about entrepreneurship. People think about entrepreneurship and they hear the story of someone like a Brian Chesky over at Airbnb, where he and Joe and Nathan start the company and they take out all of these credit card advances in order to pay their bills. And they have all the credit cards in the baseball card holder and they have like $90,000 worth of credit card debt that they owe despite having $0 in the bank. Now, that to me is downside. I don't mind if the things I do fail, but I do not want any of the things I do to crater my financial situation, my reputation, or anything that I actually consider valuable. So I'm willing to try something and not have it work. I'm unwilling to try something and have it negatively impact my life in a significant way.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. I think you and I are similar in that way. But there are, as you just told that story, but there are a bunch like that. There are many people who are willing basically to bet it all.
Like Elon Musk, for example, is an example of
Yes, and of
somebody.
course, he came within 6 weeks of basically going completely broke.
Yes. And again, I am actually willing to accept that there are levels of power that I will not be able to access because I'm simply unwilling to wager so much on a throw of the dice. And there is ultimately a ceiling to the kind of power I can have, and I'm comfortable with that ceiling.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's fine. I think everybody, I think it's one of the things we haven't discussed, but it's implied in this last little interchange. People get to decide. They are the painters of their own canvas of their life, and you could decide, and then you decide how you want to paint that canvas, whether you want to, whether you want to be, whether you want to, how ambitious you want to be, how power hungry you want to be, how risk-taking you want to be. All of these things are things that people need to decide for themselves, and they can, and every decision, as long as you're comfortable with it, is fine. But what drives me sometimes nutty is when people make a choice, but then they are not comfortable with the implications of that choice.
Yes, exactly. They want to have their cake and eat it too.
Correct.
And they are ultimately engaging in what I would call magical thinking as opposed to tough-minded realism.
Yep.
Now, we've had now a wonderful conversation that's lasted well over an hour. And I'm curious, have you learned anything about me that you didn't know before? Are there new thoughts? What sort of insights or comments do you have on what's just occurred?
I would say, have I learned anything about you that I did not know before? Not. I think I learned a little bit about your risk tolerance, which I didn't know before, that you didn't want to lose that much. But beyond that, no, because we have had, as you know, these since my wife died last 9/11, you have been very kind and very generous, and we've taken these wonderful long walks together on Sawyer Camp Trail in San Mateo. So I've actually, I think, grown both close to you and learned a lot about you. So there was no huge surprise today.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
I mean, I knew that you were smart, which you are. I knew you were kind, which you are. I knew that you were very thoughtful, which is different than being smart. Smart is just kind of raw ability. Thoughtful is actually using those smarts to think deeply about things. So no, I think this has been, I don't think some robot has taken over your body. You are the Chris that I know.
And this is also actually one of the positives that I want people to take away from this, which is, we've just had this discussion about power, and we've been very explicit about it. We've been explicit about the fact that it is desirable to have power. We've been explicit about the fact that you strategically exercise power. You think about people and they're not just as individuals, but as their potential tools to achieve what you want. We've talked about all of these things, and yet I don't think anyone then walks away and says, oh, these guys are monsters. These guys are bad people. The point is, exercising power is natural. It's a part of being a living human being and getting what you want. And why not get what you want?
That's correct. And basically the word that I would use that comes to mind as you were talking is agency or being
Yes.
agentic. I mean, that is exactly right.
That's right. And the thing about power is we have these myths about power, we have these stereotypes about power, we have these connotations that cause people to feel like somehow they can have the moral high ground if they eschew power, if they avoid the tools of power. And the answer is no, that doesn't give you a moral high ground. It just takes away your own agency. And the worst thing is you've given it away on your own accord.
And you use the word that's very important, tools. So power is a tool. You know, as I say, sometimes you can take a knife and do surgery or hold somebody up. You know, or you can take a hammer and build a house, or you can hit somebody on the head. So power is a tool. And I think it's because power, particularly in the contemporary world, has often been used for ill. People say, well, yeah, I've seen power used for ill, so I don't want it. Power can be used for good as well as the evil.
Well, Jeff, since you are becoming a podcast professional, you know that we are now at the point of the podcast where you should provide a plug, which is to say, where can they find and purchase the 7 Rules of Power? Where can they find and follow Dr. Jeff Pfeffer? Where can they find this new podcast that you're going to be putting out so that they can subscribe to it and download it and listen to it on a regular basis?
Thank you. Well, you can follow me on Jeffrey Pfeffer, which is Pfeffer, jeffreypfeffer.com. I also, you can find me, of course, on the Stanford Business School homepage. You can purchase 7 Rules of Power anywhere, including Amazon or at your favorite bookstore, assuming they still carry inventory and they still exist after Amazon. And the podcast does not yet have a subscription because we haven't launched it yet, but the podcast is going to be called Pfeffer on Power, colon, Accelerating Your Career.
Wonderful. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to put you on the spot and pre-commit you to having me as a guest on Pfeffer on Power so that we can spread our brand even further.
That is the easiest request I've ever heard. Of course, I will have you as a guest. And you, by the way, have been an extraordinarily good interviewer, which doesn't surprise me either.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this session on power with the great. The one, the only Dr. Jeff Pfeffer of Stanford University. As always, I hope that you had a educational and entertaining time listening to this podcast. Please tell your friends about it. We want more people to know this is gold. This content is incredible. And until next time, I am, as always, Chris Yeh.